Good morning. You're listening to Messin' with Herbs with Monica Rood and Nava Koningsberg. Messin' with Herbs is all about culinary and medicinal herbs, how to use them, how to grow them, how to make preparations, but also gardening and food topics and health issues. So welcome. Today, we want to start by talking about how to divide perennials, an annual fall activity. Dividing perennials is a way to get more plants from just a few and also to improve the health of the perennials you already have going by dividing them and having them not so crowded together. But before we talk about perennials, let's talk about what a perennial is, which leads us to talk about what is an annual and what is a biennial. So, Nava, do you want to start with annuals?
Sure. Good morning. It's a glorious fall morning. So, an annual plant is a plant whose entire life cycle happens in 1 year. So, you plant a seed. The seed turns into a plant. It grows. It makes leaves. It flowers. It makes seeds. And it dies. And that's the end of it. And it doesn't come back again. And plants that are annuals tend to make lots of seeds because they've just got this 1 year, and so this is how they reproduce themselves. And most of them are planted in the spring, although a few are planted the year before, in the fall, late fall, or early winter before, so that they can go through winter. But for the most annuals are planted in the spring. And they grow quickly. So you put a little tiny seed in the ground, and really fast you get a big, bright plant, usually with lots of flowers and lots of seeds. And that's an annual.
And then there are reseeding annuals,
right, which
many of them are, which means you don't have to plant them every year because they go to seed all over the place, make lots of new plants, but they might not be in the row.
And they can trick you because sometimes you think that they're perennials because you say, well, I had these flowers here last year and they're here again this year, so I guess they just keep coming back. But really, they've just dropped their seed right next to the parent plant and they're just coming up in the same place. Now, here in the Southwest, there are plants that really technically in other areas would be considered annuals, but because our winters are mild, sometimes you will have an annual that comes back again the following year, but they usually peter out. Maybe they'll come back one more year. And basically what's happening is the plant doesn't realize that the whole year's gone by, because the seasons, and that's very dependent on what kind of a year we're having, if we're having a warmer winter or a cooler winter. So you can't count on that. What you need to count on is that the plant is going to reseed itself. And Monica, as you said, oftentimes they'll throw their seeds right where you don't want them, like in the pathway or, you know, too crowded with another plant. But they also, the flip side of that is that they create a really nice naturalized look. And I think that one of the things I struggle with in my garden is I don't want things to look too formal, especially with flowers. And it's hard to plant in a sort of flowy, abstract way. And one of the nice things that freely reseeding annuals do is they sort of fill in the gaps and blur the edges a little bit in the garden. And so they can be a really nice element in garden design.
Right. Plus, you don't have to let them grow there. You can either just pull them out. Or decide where you are going to allow them to grow, or you could dig them up and transplant them to another spot.
And you can also harvest the seeds as soon as the seeds are ready so that they don't drop the seeds on their own, and then you can plant them in the spring and decide where you want them.
Right. And some examples of reseeding annuals are zinnias, cosmos, sunflowers, cilantro. Those things are really successful at reseeding themselves in our climate. Now, past annuals and reseeding annuals, we have biennials. Do you want to talk about biennials?
Sure. Well, bi means two. Annual is a derivation of the word annual. And so a biennial is a plant that starts growing the first spring, sends up usually a small, maybe a rosette of leaves the first year, grows, develops a good taproot, or a good root, and a nice little bunch of leaves, but doesn't flower that first year. And then the second year, it comes back up again and it flowers. And it's sending all that energy that was stored in the root over the winter, sends that up into a flower. And an example of that would be all of the plants, like carrots. mm-hmm. and parsley. If you let your carrots go to seed, you get these pretty white flowers the next year. But if you dig up that carrot at that point, you'll see that the root is sort of shriveled and not really worth eating anymore. So those plants, and we will talk later when we're talking about harvesting roots, we'll talk about the best times to harvest biennial plants and for all the different types. But the main idea with them is that they have a two-year cycle instead of a one-year cycle like the annuals. Then the next level up are the perennials. You want to talk about the perennials,
Monica? Well, perennials are perennial, duh. They keep coming back year after year. Some live for many, many years, like 12, 20
trees.
Trees are a perfect example of perennials. But when we talk about perennial plants, we're usually talking about things like lavender, sage, thyme, you know, rosemary, those sort of plants. And also quite a few flowers are perennials. Rose bushes are perennials. So they generally just keep getting bigger and bigger each year if they're happy, if they're in the right conditions. And some of them are what I call short-lived perennials. And this includes plants like catnip, feverfew, and motherwort. They are perennial. They do keep coming back every year. But after about the third year, when they come back, they look kind of gnarly and maybe not that healthy, and you're not sure if they're going to live or not. And some of them don't come back. So those kinds of plants do need to be replanted periodically, even though they are perennials. Fortunately, the ones that I mentioned there tend to reseed themselves pretty readily also. So generally, it's not too hard to have some new plants coming up at about the time the old ones are not looking that great. So at this time of year, we often divide the perennials. And so a couple of the main ones that we divide are yarrow and feverfew. And they tend to make a big clump of plants all crowded together, partly because they do reseed right around themselves. So to divide them, we just dig up the big clump with a shovel, dig down as deep as possible to get all the roots, and then basically take a sharp shovel and chop those big clumps into smaller pieces. Be sure that there's plenty of roots and plenty of a, you know, the ground, above ground part with each little clump, and then you just replant those.
And it, yeah. I've learned the hard way that if you break things up into too small of a bit and it doesn't have enough root on it, sometimes it'll take and sometimes it won't. So you want to find that balance of having a clump. And it depends on the plant, and this is something you just sort of have to learn from working with the plants. Some plants lend themselves really easily. Strawberries you can take, and you can divide those up into individual plants. You can sort of tease them apart and pull them apart and plant them all individually. But other plants, like when I replant feverfew and lemon balm and catnip, and those need slightly larger clump, maybe about, you know, 3 or 4 inches across, in order to have enough material there that it doesn't dry out quickly, that there's roots that haven't been damaged from the process of chopping them up. So it's really a matter of learning and figuring it out. And remember, too, that when you first transplant these, they're going to need more water than they'll need once they're established. So you have to treat them just like you treat any other little plant that you've just put in the ground and make sure that they stay well watered.
Right, and I would also mulch them, which will help them to stay moist, not dry out too much, because they're, now you have to get their new roots established. So, and a good fall and winter, most perennials actually do a lot of their root development. So that's one reason why the fall is a good time to do this, because not so much energy is going into the above portion of the plant. The plant can put its energy into making new roots and a strong root, so that when spring and early summer and hot weather comes again, it's able to adapt and resist the stress of the heat and dryness.
And, you know, one of the things that I think about, because when I garden, I'm trying to find that balance. I'm an herbalist. I want things for production. But I also, this is, you know, my home, my garden. I want it to be beautiful. And so when you're thinking about incorporating plants in the landscape, one thing that people often do is we recognize that perennial plants are going to grow more slowly. They've got a lot more time to grow, so they take their time. And so a lot of those plants start off small and take several years to get to their full size in your garden bed. And so you can plant annuals in between the perennials for a few years, and then every year as the perennials get bigger, you have less space for the annuals, and eventually the perennials will take over the bed. But that's the thing to remember about perennials is to be patient. They're not necessarily going to flower the first year, and always make sure that you give them, you have to, when you're planting them, you have to think about how much time are they going to need, how much space are they going to need ultimately, and not plant other perennials in that area so that you don't have to end up digging up more perennials than you need to.
Right, give them enough space to begin with.
And I always lose some when I divide perennials, I always lose some. So I always plan for that and try to spread them out in a way that if a few don't make it, then I can fill in the gaps later. But I think it's a great way. You know, who can afford to go out and buy 20 plants of one type? And so this way you start with one plant, and then every year you get more and more.
And if you don't want 20 plants, you can share them with your friends, neighbors, family, the guy down the road, the guy at the dump. Everybody can be gifted by these plants if you have too many.
Yeah.
So, all right, we're going to take a break now. We will be right back. Hello, we're back with Messing with Herbs with Nava and Monica. How to learn all about medicinal and culinary herbs and what to do with them. One thing you can do with them is to make honey-based remedies. That is, taking herbs and cooking them with honey to make various kinds of herbal-based extracts and syrups, etc. But first, I want to talk a little bit about honey and why honey is such a good healing material. And Nava, did you want to say something about raw honey? Why, you're not supposed to use pasteurized honey?
Honey, one of the things that makes honey so incredibly medicinal is that it's a living food, and it has lots of enzymatic qualities to it that are destroyed by cooking. And so, and when you cook it, you drastically change its makeup. And of course it can be used in cooking, but we're not, and we are going to talk about that. But when we're talking about making medicinal remedies, we want to always start with good quality honey. There's a huge crisis going on, as I'm sure everyone knows. Bees are disappearing left and right. They're getting all kinds of diseases. They are dying for unknown reasons. And it's very, very serious. If we don't have bees, we don't have many of the crops that we need. We don't have fruit. We don't, you know, we really, really depend on bees. And honey, they make honey for themselves. They don't make it for us. And so what's happening now is that beekeepers and the whole bee industry is really struggling to figure out how to keep the bees healthy. And bees do not like chemicals. They don't like drugs, but you have to be careful making sure that whoever you're buying your honey from, that their bees were getting the pollen from the flowers in areas that haven't been sprayed and that are clean and that the bees are healthy. And you always want to make sure that you're getting honey from a good source. Honey is a little difficult to come by here in the Southwest. One of the problems with raising bees around here is that because we don't get really strong winters, the bees don't fully hibernate and they end up eating a lot of their honey up. And so it's sometimes you have to get honey from other areas. But if you've gotten your honey and it's raw honey, and by raw I mean that it hasn't been heated above 110 degrees, those enzymes and all that good stuff that I was talking about, all the medicinal properties, are destroyed by heating over that temperature. One of the ways that you know that honey is raw is that if it sits around long enough, it will start to crystallize. It'll start to harden. And that is fine. That honey is perfectly good. That is the honey's own way of preserving itself. And crystallized honey will stay good indefinitely. If you buy cooked honey, that does have the ability to go bad, but to ferment. But raw honey, if you just let it be, keep it in a cool place, keep it out of light and heat, it will crystallize, and then you just scoop it out. And then if you want to reliquefy it again. You just take some of that honey, and what I do is I just keep it in the jar and put it in some warm water and let the crystallized honey just liquefy again, and then it'll stay liquid for a while, and then you can use it, and then if you leave it long enough, it'll recrystallize. But that's the best way to get and preserve and use your honey. So, Monica, what are we going to do with all this great honey other than...
Well, first I want to talk about a couple of other medicinal virtues of raw honey. So after you've scoured the universe and found your raw, unfiltered, unpasteurized honey, you can use it externally. It can actually, believe it or not, be applied to the face, where it's antimicrobial and it's very healing for acne and other skin eruptions. All you have to do is rub it onto your face just before you get in the shower, and then wash it off. And it makes the complexion clear, and it moistens the skin and softens it and gives it a healthy sheen. Honey actually attracts water. And so it brings moisture to your face, and it does the same thing when you bake with it, which I'll talk about in a little bit.
One thing I want to say about the cosmetic use of honey is that, you know, there's a big movement now. Everybody wants to get in on the natural bandwagon, on the herbal bandwagon, and so there are a lot of products out there that list themselves as being made with honey, cosmetic things. But remember what we just talked about, how honey in the process of cooking it and processing it loses a lot of its medicinal qualities. And so I think we should be a little suspicious of what process these companies have put their honey through in order to make a shampoo or a lotion or something, and how much, I don't know the answer to this, but how much of the medicinal properties of the honey are actually left once you've gone through this extensive processing. So this is an opportunity to use the raw stuff right there. You don't have to pay somebody else. It doesn't have to come in a bottle. Use your own honey and to make your own cosmetics.
Also, honey is an excellent topical treatment for burns and suppurative infections. And suppurative infections are ones that have pus or gangrene in them. What they do is they soak sterile gauze bandages in the honey and layer it on the burn or affected area. And then those bandages are renewed a few times a day. And the influence is very antibiotic, and it accelerates healing. And this treatment also results in reduced scar formation. And they're starting to actually use honey to treat burns in some hospitals. Like in Boston, I know there are a couple of hospitals that are using honey therapy to treat burns. Honey alone is a traditional treatment for upset stomach, heartburn, and gastritis caused by overindulgence in alcoholic beverages. And otherwise, it's good for a hangover. The influence is calmative, warming, moistening, and healing. Honey also inhibits the growth of a bacteria called Helicobacter pylori, which is the organism that is responsible for the formation of gastric ulcers. Honey contains pollen grains from a wide variety of local plants. And so by using local honey, it can help people with local allergies to local pollens, because it helps the body to develop antibodies specifically against those pollens.
I do want to point out, though, that many people here suffer from juniper allergies, and juniper trees do not make flowers, and therefore you can't get juniper flower honey. So although honey can generally help reduce stress and support immunity, it's not going to specifically help you with your juniper allergies.
Right, just flower.
Allergies, yes.
Mm-hmm. So this is obviously how great honey is. And Nava's going to talk a little bit about some honey-based remedies that she makes. Like Osha is one you make, right?
Well, what I was going to talk more generally about, what I make is every fall I make a cough syrup. And I use a lot of different plants in it. And I'm not going to get into the details of all of them. I use Osha and elecampane and cherry bark. And the basic idea is that I'm making a cough syrup, taking plants that are, relaxing to the lungs and expectorant and calming coughs and breaking up phlegm and all that stuff. And I make them into a honey because the honey itself is so soothing. And I especially find that the cough syrup compared to other remedies that I make for coughs and lung problems, where teas and tinctures tend to help with breaking up the phlegm and opening up the lungs, the honey-based one really seems to be amazing at calming that spasmy cough. You know, you're sort of maybe getting over being sick, but every time you lie down, you start coughing and you can't stop yourself. The honey, for some reason, I don't know why, it just stops it immediately, even better than just putting honey in a cup of tea. And so again, the problem is that I want to use the honey as a solvent, right? I'm basically making an extract and I'm using honey as my liquid and I'm trying to get the medicine from the plant into the honey. And I usually use fresh plants. The thing to remember is that fresh plants have their own water in them. So what you end up with is a slightly more watered down honey. And that's okay as long as it's not too much and you can evaporate that out. I've experimented with a lot of different ways of doing it. Some people make a tea first and then evaporate out the tea and replace it with honey. I find that personally, I don't think that's as good a product as just steeping the herbs directly in the tea. So I take my roots or my barks or whatever I'm going to do and I put them in a crock pot and cover them with honey, and I never allow that temperature to get more than warm. I never allow it to get over 110 degrees. And it's a multi-day process of just turning the crock pot on and turning the crock pot off, making sure it doesn't get too hot. I've ruined several batches, I can tell you, by thinking I was turning the crock pot to off and accidentally turning it to high and going to bed and coming out the next morning and there's honey boiled over everywhere and the whole batch is ruined. I've had to throw out a few crock pots too. But ultimately, it's worth it. You can do it on a double boiler. You can try to do it on a stove. It's pretty hard to keep the temperature regulated. Some people don't cook it, don't even heat it at all. They just put it in a jar, maybe with a tiny bit of alcohol over the herbs, and just let it sit out in a sunny window or something and just sort of be warm that way, or in an oven, sort of similar to the way we make our oils, put it in an oven that has a burner pilot light going, so any kind of warm place. I like warming it. It liquefies it a little bit and gets the medicine to come out into the honey. And then when I'm done, I just strain it out. And sometimes some of the plants I use, like ginger, after you've strained the honey off, now you've got all this ginger that's been soaked, fresh ginger that's been soaked in honey. It's also absorbed some of the honey. Put that out on cookie sheets, put it in a very low heat in an oven, let it evaporate out or put it near evaporator, and now you've got candied ginger to munch on also, which is delicious.
I know, people love that stuff. So let's back up. I have a question here.
Sure.
So the fresh herbs, when you put them in the crock pot, do you chop them up fine or coarse?
Well, it depends. The ones that I'm going to use later to make into their own little candies, like the ginger and the osha, I just cut into nice sort of bite-sized chunks. It really depends on what the herbs are. The finer you chop it, the more surface area there is and the easier it is for the honey to extract it. So I just kind of chop it up into smallish pieces and cover it up. And there's a few that I do dry. Lavender is one that I do dry just because
So you use dried lavender flowers.
I use dried lavender flowers, and really it's just because I get my honey and I'm sort of in the mental state of making my cough syrup in the fall, and so I just sort of do it all at once. And people could theoretically, if you had all your plants there and you gathered them all up together, you could throw all the herbs in together and just make one big thing. I like to have a little more control over the situation, and not everything is ready at the same time. So back a few months ago, I incorporated the leafy things that I was putting in, like the wild oregano and the thyme and stuff. And so that honey's already made. And then when it's time to make my cough syrup, I follow my recipe and I add, you know, some of this one and some of that one, and I end up with a really lovely cough syrup. There's lots of different ways to do it. The most important thing is to remember to start with good quality plant material and clean it very well before you put it in and have it be dry before you put it in with the honey. And start with good honey and keep the temperature low. Do not let it go above 110. And just be patient.
And when you're cooking it in the crock pot, do you have the lid on it or is it uncovered?
I keep the lid on in the beginning because One of the things is that a lot of the plants that we use for coughs in particular have lots of aromatics. They have lots of oils in them. The things that make them smell so wonderful will just evaporate right out. So I keep them keep it covered for the first few days while I'm extracting it. And then at the end, when it's mostly done, I'll leave the lid off for a little bit just to let some of that extra water evaporate out and try not to get too many of the aromatics to escape.
Sounds yummy.
It is really yummy. And you can totally do this any way you want. You can make a one herb one or a multi one, and it's a great way to use honey.
All right. We're going to take a break now. We will be right back. We are back. You're still listening to Messing with Herbs with Nava and Monica. And we've been talking about honey-based remedies. So I have a couple of questions about that, Nava. One is, how do you store this cough remedy with honey after you make it? Does it have to be refrigerated? Does it still crystallize? And also, what are some good herbs? How do you decide what kind of herbs to put in there?
Sure. So the storage is pretty simple. With most things, you want to keep them in a cool, dry area. I've never had any of my medicinal honeys crystallize after I make them. It could be because of some of the properties in the plants themselves. It could be because there's a little bit more water in it. I don't really know. And I've never had any of them go bad. Of course, I don't keep them for more than a year because I'm using them up. But theoretically, they should stay good for quite a while. And once the cough syrup's made, it stays good for years.
So does it have to be refrigerated?
It does not have to be refrigerated. What I do is sometimes I'll tell people, well, if you're not going to use it, it's the off season and summer's coming, just stick it in the fridge. But then when you're in it, when you're in the cough and cold season, just keep it out available so that you can use it. It does thicken up more, of course, if it gets refrigerated and makes it a little harder to pour. But just store it in clean glass jars in darkness. That's the main thing. You want to keep it away from sunlight and keep it away from heat, and it should be fine.
So actually, you want to keep it on the counter so it will be at room temperature, because refrigerated honey is pretty hard to pour.
It's very hard to pour, yes. So if you're not using it for a while and you want to stick it in the fridge, if you feel more comfortable, go for it. But I don't, and my honey, I've never had any batches go bad on me. The plants themselves are so antibacterial that they... And the other thing is that, again, honey itself is highly antibacterial. And so if you haven't overcooked it and destroyed those properties, and you've made it well so that you haven't lost all the medicine, then it takes care of itself for the most part. So, and that brings to you asked about what kinds of plants that I use. And really the only product that I make currently is my cough syrup. So of course I look for plants that are helpful for coughs. Things that are, as I said, you know, things like OSHA that are going to help fight both the virus itself and also help open up the lungs, thin the mucus, relax things, cherry bark, which is wonderful if you've got a bad cough. So if you're ever out in the woods and you come upon a cherry tree, one of those wild cherry trees, and you sort of scrape the bark a little bit, you get this absolutely heavenly aroma of cherry bark, of cherry. It's really lovely. But the main thing to remember when you're thinking about what herbs you want to use in honey is, I was talking before about those aromatics, and that is something that honey does really well. And in the course of our talks over the next months, we're going to talk about how to make things with water and how to make things with alcohol. And each of those different types of solvents has its own unique properties as far as what things it pulls out of a plant. And one of the things that the honey seems to be particularly good at pulling out of a plant are those aromatic oils, those volatile oils. And those aromatic properties of plants tend to be, in general, antibacterial, often antiviral, warming to the body, stimulating to the circulatory system, relaxing to the system. I mean, all of them are different. A lot of people have been coming in lately asking about oregano oil, and a lot of people use lavender oil, and those are the super concentrated versions of these aromatics that naturally exist in the plants. And when you extract them in honey, you don't get that super concentrated version, but you do get those out, and they do have wonderful, wonderful medicinal properties. So I encourage people to experiment And I roots, as I said, hold up really well. Remember, you're going to be heating it for a while. And so sometimes very fragile plants, like I've never tried making a chamomile honey. It probably could, and it would probably be fine, but it might also just be so fragile that it sort of all clumps together. So I like things that will are a little hardier and that will hold up a little bit.
Well, also chamomile can be bitter. It seems like the bitterness would be brought out.
Well, on the other hand, the honey would help balance the bitterness.
Oh, maybe. So, huh.
And remember, too, that if you didn't make a syrup or a something with the honey, that adding honey to your tea is amazing. And one of the things that I tell people often is if that they have to drink a bad-tasting tea. Here's my secret for drinking bad-tasting tea. I learned this the hard way. If you just add honey to the tea, then it still tastes terrible, and now it's really sweet. And so I always tell people to add enough lemon to cover up the taste of the tea, and then just add enough honey to take the edge off the lemon. And that works really well for me as a way of getting down. You know, Mary Poppins didn't say spoonful of sugar. I'm sure she said spoonful of honey, and it was just mistranslated somehow in the film.
I'm sure. Well, I have a couple of other tidbits about honey, since we seem to be talking about honey. I learned that a strong hive, beehive, includes one mature queen, a few hundred drones, which are the males, and 20,000 female workers. So that's what it takes for a hive to produce honey. For every quart of honey that is taken away and taken to market, another 8 pounds of honey are used by the hive in its daily activity. So that's what they all eat to stay active. The total flight path required for a bee to gather enough nectar for a pound, this 1 pound of honey, is the equivalent of 3 orbits around the Earth. That's how much bees have to fly to get 1 pound of honey.
That's why they call them busy bees, huh?
Absolutely. And listen to this. The average bee makes up to 25 round trips a day from the hive out to the flowers, and they can go as far as a mile each time. So theoretically, a bee could travel 25 miles a day to get you your little spoonful of honey, Mary Poppins.
We sometimes get calls from people who have beehives in their houses. Sometimes bees will, you know, get in somewhere. And I really, really would beg and encourage people to deal with the situation in a way that involves moving the bees and not killing the bees. As I mentioned before, we need these bees. They're dying out. We want to support them helping us and doing what they do and making honey and all of these things. And so make sure when you call someone to help you that it's someone who's going to move the hive and not just kill the hive.
Right. I try to call someone who is actually a beekeeper, and they know how to do that as opposed to just destroying them. That's a good point. I wanted to talk a little bit about cooking with honey.
Okay.
A lot of times honey is put into baked goods because it causes browning. And if you put in too much honey, and if you bake it too long, of course, your baked products can be too brown. But that's one of the reasons that honey is sometimes used instead of white sugar.
Why would you want something to be brown, more brown?
Well, you want your cookies to be brown, and you want your bread to be nicely brown on top, and as opposed to pale white or light colored. A certain amount of browning is desirable in baked goods. And so the honey, you don't need as much honey as you do white sugar. So if you're using a recipe that calls for white sugar, or any sugar really, and also it's liquid. So 1 cup of honey is the equivalent of 1 1/4 cups of regular sugar. And also you would need to reduce the amount of liquid in the recipe by 1/4 cup in order to turn out with the right amount of liquid.
Except here in the Southwest, we're at high altitude, we need more liquid to compensate for altitude, so...
Well, it's all an experiment. You have to figure
this
out.
This is why I don't bake very much.
Well, people who know how to bake know how to do these things, these magical conversions. So we're going to take a break again, and we will be right back. another thing about baking with honey is honey is an antioxidant, so it keeps baked goods from getting stale as quickly as using sugar, and it also helps to retain the moisture better than using sugar in baked goods.
There's two groups that I also wanted to mention that might need a little bit of special attention when talking about honey. The first is infants under 12 months old. Even though honey is absolutely wonderful, some of it does contain a bacteria, Clostridium bacteria, that in an immature digestive tract can cause botulism. So you do want to avoid giving infants over 12 months old raw honey. They can have cooked honey because the process, you know, in baked goods and stuff, but they shouldn't have raw honey. The other group I get asked about a lot are diabetics. And I think there's a lot of controversy. Can diabetics use honey? And it's a hard one because it is a sugar. And there is some debate. Some people say, well, it's just as refined by the bees as anything else is. I tend to love honey and think that some of the positive benefits of it for health and the digestive tract balance it out. And what I tell people is, well, use a little bit of it. You know, you can have, even if you're diabetic, you know, if you're watching your sugars, if you're watching what else you eat, if you're exercising, it doesn't mean you can never have anything sweet ever. You know, everything in moderation. And I think that given the choices that we have for artificial sweeteners out there, which are so bad for you and do so many terrible things, that honey in context and in moderation can be a wonderful addition. A lot of people who have diabetes also have other health problems going on that the honey can be really helpful with. So I would encourage people with diabetes to consider it, again, in moderation, certainly as a substitute for sugar. I think it would be a lot better.
Another tip for buying honey, it's important that it hasn't been obtained from flowers and plants growing in an area where genetically modified crops are growing, because it's well known that the pollen from some of those crops do contain pesticide residues, which can be transferred into the honey. So it pays to know your source when you're buying honey.
And the way the laws are right now, you don't have to be notified that the plants were genetically modified. In fact, when you buy anything in the supermarket, they don't have to tell you on the package that the apples and the apple pie you're buying were genetically modified or anything like that.
Right.
And so that's another reason to buy locally, make sure that you develop a relationship with your beekeeper. Beekeepers are very interesting people.
Yeah, they're oddballs.
But, you know, one of the things I've heard about bees is that bees like to know all the gossip. They want to know what's going on in town. And so people who keep bees talk to their bees and let them know what's going on and have a relationship with these insects. I mean, they're the only members of the insect community that we have such a intimate relationship with. And they're pretty magnificent, I think.
They certainly are. I just wanted to clarify one thing you said before, and that is using honey for infants. We don't usually give it to infants until they're at least 12 months old, because before that is when they tend to possibly develop some problems with it. So that's your tip on giving honey to your babies.
Now we're moving into our cooking part of the show. And, you know, Monica, it's been getting chilly out. And I notice that, you know, nights are cold, mornings are cold. I've been thinking about getting my wood stove hooked up. And so I was wondering if you could recommend to us a nice, warming, sort of maybe more hearty soup, maybe one that can help us make the adjustment into these autumn days.
Well, yes, you know, it was 32 degrees in Gila last night.
Oh, my goodness.
It was a little scary. I walked through the garden, and I didn't see any sign of frost, but it could be tonight.
Oh, boy.
So, yes.
Sorry, I have to go. I'm going to go work in my garden.
Go cover up your plants. So, yeah, the mornings are cooler. I'm starting to eye the wood pile where everything is waiting and think about cleaning the chimney and so forth. But the soup I wanted to talk about today actually is a miso soup.
What's miso?
Miso. I'm going to tell you all about miso in a minute. This soup is ginger miso soup with arami. And ginger is really great for cold weather. It's very warming and comforting and makes this house smell good. And arami is a kind of seaweed that's very mild flavored. If you're not familiar with seaweed or you think you don't like seaweed, arami is a good one to start with because it's easy to make it taste good and it doesn't have a real strong flavor and it's kind of stringy. You can buy it wherever you buy seaweed and it's in these little strips and you just soak it ahead of time and add it to the recipe, which I will explain after I tell you all about miso. Miso is actually a Japanese food, and it's a fermented soybean paste. It originated in China about 2,500 years ago, and they were still using it, so I guess it must be good for something. The way it's made is they take the cooked soybeans and a certain kind of mold culture called koji, that's K-O-J-I, and salt and various kinds of grains, like rice is one that's commonly used. All these ingredients are fermented from six months to 2 years. And when you see there's a wide range of prices in miso, that gives you an idea. If it's only been fermented for 6 months, of course, it's going to be less expensive. And there are many varieties of miso, many colors, different flavors, different textures. Some are more salty, some are less salty. The darker ones are the ones that have been fermented for a long time, and they're especially good for people to eat who are living in cold climates or for us in the winter, or if you just like a really strong taste. I used to have one that I swear to God tasted like chocolate. Someone gave me a whole gallon of it, and it tasted just like chocolate, and it made a most delicious broth, and I was so sad when it finally ran out many, like dozens of years later.
So it stays good.
Yeah.
For
indefinitely. Yes, it gets salt crystals in it, but it doesn't mold or
But you keep it anything. Refrigerated?
No, you don't have to. Well, you know, the ones that you buy in the store, they tell you to keep it refrigerated, but this one, believe me, did not need refrigeration.
Wow.
Nothing happened to it. It was just really, really almost black and was wonderful.
You know, that brings up an interesting point, that there are many, many foods that specifically were developed because people didn't have refrigeration.
Right.
And now we just sort of automatically refrigerate anything. And a lot of times it's because we're pasteurizing things now that weren't pasteurized before. And like we were talking about with the honey, these living foods often will stay good for a long time because they have their own enzymatic actions going on that keep them good. So,
right, and miso is something I like to take camping because you don't have to keep it cold. So some of the misos are darker, some are light, and so they've been fermented not as long. They're lighter in color and milder in flavor, and they're better for warm weather or warmer climates. And then there are medium ones that are more of a red color, so they're kind of medium flavored, and they're good for year-round use or when we're in a more moderate weather. So I think it's good just to experiment and see what flavors you like and just start out with a little bit. Don't start eating a whole bunch all at once. But the reason that the miso is so beneficial is that it's very high in protein. It can be anywhere from 13 to 20% protein. And the amino acids that make up the protein have an amino acid pattern that's similar to meat. And so it gives it a very meaty property. And a lot of times miso broth is so much like beef broth or other meat broths that even people who are meat eaters would swear to God they're eating a meat broth. And I often put it in vegetarian chili. And then I put in chunks of mushrooms, especially shiitake mushrooms, which can be a little bit chewy. And people think they're eating meat. I swear to God. It's a great thing to give meat eaters when you don't want to give them meat. And of course, it's a lot more economical than meat, and it doesn't spoil.
Wow.
It also contains trace mineral trace amounts of vitamin B12. And it's a live food. It contains lactobacillus, just like yogurt. So it's a fermented food that's very beneficial to digestion and helps to balance out the bacterial flora in our GI system. And it's a really, really good substitute for that broth that they give you at the hospital when you're just out of surgery. And usually the first thing they give you is a salty beef broth. Well, if they gave miso, it would be so much better. Miso is very comforting, healing, balancing. It's alkalizing to the body. It's a really, really good thing to eat when you're sick or not feeling good or feeling out of balance. It's very balancing.
So you were talking about all the enzymes and all that mm-hmm. stuff. So are those destroyed by cooking, or is there a special way that you have to prepare it so that you don't destroy them?
As a matter of fact, they are destroyed by cooking. And I'm glad you asked that question, because the way to use miso is to add it right at the end of the cooking when you take it off the heat. So if you're making soup, you put it in right at the very end. Or what I usually do, since I'm not going to eat the whole pot of soup at once, and when you heat the pot of soup up tomorrow, you could be destroying the bacteria. What I do is I just put the miso in my bowl and then put a little bit of the soup in there and stir it up until it's dissolved, and then I add the rest of my serving.
So how much would you put in a bowl?
It depends on how strong the miso is. With that really strong dark stuff I was telling you about, I would use about a quarter of a teaspoon.
Wow, not very much.
But if it's the blonde, really mild stuff, a teaspoon probably is good. But again, it's good to experiment and see how much you like. It can be salty, especially the darker, longer fermented ones tend to be pretty salty. So you definitely don't need to add soy sauce or other sources of salt to the soup if you're going to use miso. In China, they believe that using miso promotes long life as well as good health. And I once read that in Japan, it was considered a good bride knew 365 ways to make miso soup.
So every day she could make her husband a different
one. You never get bored with it. So other advantages of incorporating miso into your diet is because it can be used to treat and prevent radiation sickness. It just helps you not to get radiation sickness. It also neutralizes the effects of smoking and air pollution. It also has the ability, which is not so good, to absorb toxins from a plastic container. This is something I just learned. So when you bring it home from the store, you need to take it out of that plastic container and put it in a glass jar.
That is becoming an increasing problem with many of our foods.
It certainly is. It certainly is. So it's easy to incorporate into soups, gravies, sauce, dressings, dips, casseroles, anything. And there are lots of recipes available online, and it's pretty yummy. Pretty yummy. But today's recipe, which I will talk about briefly, but you don't have to madly be writing down all these ingredients, because you can find this recipe if you go to our webpage on the radio station's website, which is gmcr.org. Just go to that website and click on Messing with Herbs, and you will find the recipe for ginger miso soup with arami. So briefly, this is what you do is take a little bit of the arami, which is the seaweed, and soak it in water for 5 minutes. And the amount that you use is just 2 pinches. You don't need much because it's going to absorb water and expand. And this is just a small amount of soup. It's not a whole big pot. So while the arami is soaking, you heat oil in a saucepan. And when it's hot, you add mushrooms and onions. I like to use the little button mushrooms or else shiitakes. Shiitakes really enhance the immune system, so I always feel like I'm doing good things for myself when I use shiitakes. But you can use any kinds of mushrooms, and they can be fresh or dried. So they are sautéed for a couple of minutes in the hot oil, and then you add fresh ginger, which has been peeled and minced finely. Put that in there and then add water and bring it to a boil and add that vegetable broth powder or mushroom powder or one of those kinds of, or a bouillon cube, preferably one that has no salt, because when you put the miso in, it's going to be very salty. So you simmer that for 5 minutes, and then you dissolve 3 tablespoons of miso in the soup, or like I was saying, just a little bit in your bowl, and add some of the hot soup and mix it up. And add the arami to the soup at the last minute and heat it and put it in your bowl. And you can garnish it with scallions if you want, or cilantro or parsley or any of those green things. And that's it.
Sounds delicious.
So it's very fast.
So when the arami is salty too, though, mm-hmm. right? So it's not too salty when you
Soak it, a lot of the salt, you get a lot of the salt
out. So you soak it and then you remove it from the water you soaked it in, and then you put it in.
Right. Okay. And you put it in at the end.
Okay.
It doesn't really need much cooking.
Now, do people who have issues with eating salt need to, is it the same, or can they eat miso?
Well, it's really salty. So you need to cut down, if you wanted to eat this, and you really were on salt restrictions, you would probably want to try the milder misos, which are lower in salt, and then just put in a little tiny bit and then not eat any salt for the rest of the day, maybe. Reduce any other sources of salt that you might be eating, so you might be able to get away with it. It just depends on how strict your salt restrictions are.
Okay. That sounds delicious.
The really easy thing to do with miso is just put like a half a teaspoon in a cup and bring water almost to a boil and pour it in the cup and stir it until it dissolves, and then add just the tiniest dash of soy sauce just to give it a little more body. You don't want to make it any more salty. And then just stir that up and drink it. Oh, it is so, it's very good for traveling when you're stressed out, because it immediately helps you calm down and feel more balanced. It's very nurturing. Eating miso is one of the best things you can do for yourself.
It's also really good because it does, because of the salts that it has and the nutrients that it has and the absorbability of it, it's really good for someone who has gotten dehydrated or someone who's been sick for a while and is just depleted. Oftentimes when people can't eat because they're feeling sick and they're feverish, it's a great sort of restitutional, you know, bringing somebody back and being one of the first things. It's so easy to digest and absorb that it's a great way to just get nutrients into someone easily and quickly. And sometimes if they're dehydrated or just exhausted from fever, that's a really great way to get that back into them again.
It sure is. It's a great remedy for when you're not feeling well.
Yeah. And it's very soothing. I find it very soothing to the throat. Uh-huh. And
it is. I think I'm going to go eat some right now. Well, that's it for this time. You've been Messing with Herbs with Nava and Monica. We'll see you next time.
Have a great week.